At Car Advice, we always say push the dealer to give you a 24-hour test drive. Now, I know that's going to be harder if you're younger. I understand that. But maybe take your parents along if you can, or a relative if your parents aren't available. Because what that allows you to do is it allows you to take the vehicle home. Does it fit in your garage? Does it get up your driveway? Can you put your golf bag in the back if you play golf? If you water ski, or if you, you know, go to the gym, does your gym bag fit in it? If you carry your mates around to and from work, have they got enough room in the second row? All those little things. And then also test driving it on roads that you drive every day. So, you know, we all live in Sydney. The Sydney road network is absolute rubbish, right? So if you buy a sports car that's got really firm suspension and you've got to go banging and crashing over awful roads every day to and from work, you might hate your life not long after you buy the car. So always push for a 24-hour test drive. And I think the other one that a lot of people don't think of is servicing costs. So factor that in. Now we're in a situation where most manufacturers give you cap price servicing. So factor that in. If you know that for the first 5 years, it's going to cost you X amount per year, you add that to the price of the car. Don't, if you've got $25,000 to spend, don't spend $25,000 and one on the car and then have no money left to service it for that first year. Always leave a little bit in reserve.
Before we get into this episode today with Trent Nikolic from caradvice.com.au, just wanted to jump in and have a shout out to our new show partner. Who
Sun
are
Super.
They, John?
Sun Super.
Sun Super.
You know when you buy a red car,
yeah,
you start to see red cars everywhere?
Oh, you've seen Sun
I've
Super
seen
everywhere.
I've seen them around.
Yeah.
You? No.
No. Well, I mean, sure. Absolutely, yeah, seen them everywhere. But, you know, they've got strong and competitive investment performance. Their balanced option has beaten the industry average over 1, 3, 5, 7, and 10 years. And that was a source from Super Ratings.
That'll do me.
Yeah, so 10. It wasn't them saying that, no. It was someone else. So,
that's right.
Solid performance, good competitive fee structure.
Yeah.
Hey, not telling you to use them, I'm telling you to consider them when you are reviewing your superannuation needs.
Yeah.
Remember, not financial advice.
Put them in the mix.
Show partner.
Yeah, just put them in the mix. Yeah. But while I say that,
yeah.
Isn't this meant to be independent, non-biased approach to...
I never really ever claim that. I'm making an infotainment podcast.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't work for free, neither do you.
Yeah.
And our editor needs to be paid.
Yeah.
But I will say, we get pitched daily.
Yes.
With different products and services.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of due diligence that goes into our show partners.
Yeah. And a lot of them are trash.
Not our show partners, but like...
No, the ones that pitch to us, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's just irrelevant.
Yes.
I mean, don't pitch to me a retirement thing. Like, because we've got our average listeners is age 27. So I just want to say, like, it is a quality product. They do sponsor this podcast. It's a free world.
Yeah.
And it just helps us bring the content to not charge people for that.
Yeah, and then probably, if I can say this, it allows us to go up another level, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's it. And so next year, we're ramping up education content, like turning it up to 11.
Quality of people, guests are going to rise another level, if that's possible.
If that's possible.
Yeah.
Not sure.
Unfortunately, the hosts, they'll stay the same.
Yeah. Remember when we did the census, when someone's like, what do you want to hear less of? And they're like, Glenn.
Pretty hard. Turn the volume down.
So thanks, Sun Super, our show partner, for partnering with My Millennial Money. Now let's get back into this episode.
Let's do this.
We're with Trent Nikolic. He's the managing editor from caradvice.com.au, and they're basically the leading car review website authority in Australia. You'll see and hear Trent and his colleagues on the Today Show, Weekend Today, across the Macquarie Radio Network. Basically, they're the go-to for the media when they want to know about cars. How many cars do you test drive a month?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Look, I'd go through, I'd probably drive up to 5 cars a week.
Yeah.
Different cars a week.
Cool.
Yeah.
Quite easily.
Yeah. You know your way around the steering wheel, let's say. Yeah.
I do.
Now, straight into it.
Mm.
We both met when we were both on segments on the Your Money TV show.
That's right.
At that time, I think your life was blowing up because it was pre-election and,
yeah.
and Bill Shorten basically was mandating that every Tom, Dick and Harry will have an electric car in 2 years. I'm being over the top here.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about
2030, wasn't it?
Yeah. I want to talk about electric vehicles. Mm. So you're in the car world.
Yep.
When do you think they'll actually be the norm?
It's pretty timely, actually, because I just came back from overseas. I was test driving the Porsche Taycan, which is their electric vehicle. Yeah. We've been saying at Car Advice for a long time that the whole landscape would change when the mainstream manufacturers started building electric cars. So Tesla, you know, obviously Tesla is Tesla and everybody thinks Elon Musk is the messiah. But the problem is, with him, for example, a lot of people say, hey, Elon, can you just start delivering cars that people have paid money for? And he says, oh, look over here, I've just launched a rocket.
And your company's just had a $1 billion loss last year.
Exactly. So they still haven't made a cent on a car. What you'll find with the mainstream manufacturers and where it'll change, and when you're asking how quickly it'll change when it gets to the point that it can actually be profitable for them. So obviously Porsche is at the higher end of the purchasing spectrum. Our listeners here are probably, you know, if they're looking at an electric vehicle, it'd be something like a Nissan Leaf, which is just under 50,000 drive away. There's a Hyundai Ioniq, which is about $40,000. And then there's a Hyundai Kona in there as well, in that mid 40 grand price bracket. People will be looking at those a lot more because they're realistic. I think what needs to happen is a convergence of two things. The range of the vehicles has to be realistic. Now, yes, we don't drive 500 kilometres a day. We all know that. But we still have a car that has the capability of doing that with a full tank of fuel. We need that kind of range out of an electric vehicle. We also need to be able to charge them quicker. Now, I won't bore your listeners to sleep with all the different facts and figures, but what I will tell you is that all things being equal, in a best case scenario, the Porsche that we drove overseas, you can charge it, as we did, from about 20% up to 85%. In about 25 minutes.
Wow.
Now, that's a lot quicker than what we're used to. The problem is the charging network in Australia won't have access to that speed for some time. You won't be able to do it at home in your garage.
Do you need 20 amps at home or 10?
No, well, that's the other thing too. See, what a lot of people think of when they talk about electric cars, and your listeners will be thinking this now, they think the point that I plug my toaster or my vacuum cleaner into is how I charge the car. Sure, that'll take you 36 hours with a Tesla Model S. If it's at 10%, it'll take you forever to get it back up. So what you actually need, and this is we're talking about factoring in money when you're spending money on cars, you're going to need to factor in about $2,000 to $2,500 on top of your vehicle purchase to have a proper charge box installed at home. Now, what that'll do is that'll charge the car in about 8 hours overnight if it's down at 20%. Get home, in the driveway, plug it in. Next morning, it's ready to go. The problem we're going to have is that the charging time needs to come right down, which has got to do with the battery capacities and the packs themselves and what they can accept. And I'll give you an example, which is pretty easy to understand. The chargers that we used for the Porsche drive, they will output, best case scenario, 350 kilowatts. The Taycan will only take in 270 kilowatts. So the battery pack yet can't charge at that full rate because it'll overheat and it's not good for longevity and what have you. So I think there's a few things that need to happen. But anybody who thinks they need to rush out and buy an electric car tomorrow, you don't need to be panicking. You can obviously think about it down the track and factor it into your planning, but I wouldn't be panic buying one in the next 12 months, for example.
And would you say they've become more cost-effective over time as more models come out?
That is such a tough question, mate, because we've had two sides of the story, right? Someone said to me the other day, will increase demand or bring price down.
Yep.
And I waved my mobile phone in front of him and he said, what do you mean? I said, that's the most expensive iPhone I've ever bought. People are buying more of them than they ever have.
Mm.
Why isn't it $500?
Yeah.
Right?
Because it's a racket.
Apple, exactly. Look, that's a bit of a simplistic argument, but I don't necessarily think increased demand brings prices down. Dual cab utes, right? Top two selling vehicles in Australia, Hilux and Ranger.
Yeah.
They're more expensive than they've ever been.
Yeah.
The thing is, I don't know that demand will bring the price down. The other thing we can't seem to get the manufacturers to give us a matching answer on, like BMW will tell you one thing, Mercedes will tell you something else. The battery packs currently, as we know them now, are made up of a hell of a lot of exotic metals, you know, lithium and cobalt, things that you got to dig out of the ground. The question is, the demand for gold goes up and the price goes up because it's scarce. Diamonds, whatever it might be. These are effectively the building block version of those exotic stones and minerals, right? Now, BMW, they locked in the price of their lithium and cobalt supply about 18 months ago. They told us for the next 10 years because they reckon the price will go up. They don't actually think it'll come down. And that's the concern. Maybe we change the way we do batteries. Maybe we look at battery technology. Maybe it gets cheaper to build the batteries if we use different materials to build them. You know, like we're using lithium now, lithium ion instead of lead acid, for example, in battery packs in mobile phones and whatever else. So I just don't think that it will get cheaper.
Yeah.
Just because the demand goes up.
Okay. So last question before we move on from electrics.
Sure.
Is how many Ks would you get out of the average charge?
Yeah, so if you look at something that's affordable, so the Nissan Leaf has about a 270-kilometre range. The Hyundai Kona, which is their little SUV, that sort of has about a... It's up to 400 Ks right. range in that one, which is a lot more useful
yeah.
for a lot of people, a little bit more expensive. Hyundai Ioniq, again, it's down around that 270-kilometre range. Now, what I'd tell your listeners, if they're thinking about buying one... If you know your driving habits 99% of the time, that's fine.
Yeah.
Because with the Leaf, we had one as a long-termer, right? So we had it in the office for 6 months and we'd give it to people to commute with for certain blocks of time. I live 20 kilometres from our office. We're in North Sydney. I live in the inner west. If I drive from home to the office and back, I can do that for a week basically
yeah.
without having to charge. I can also charge it at the office because we've got a wall box and I can plug it into a normal plug at home. So it's pretty much always charged at the end and the start yeah. of each day. It makes a lot of sense. But I think until the range is a genuine, say, 500 kilometres, you can't really recommend them to someone as their only vehicle.
Yeah, and I think in the electric vehicle world... the conversation will actually start to change from kilometres to hours.
Yeah.
It's got to because that's...
Kind of has to.
Battery.
Yeah,
it's like, it actually doesn't matter how many kilometres. No. It's how many hours at normal driving conditions or extreme driving conditions.
Yeah, and one last one on that is it's very hard to measure, right? Because it's the same as fuel consumption figures. When you buy a car and they say it uses, yeah. you know, 5.7 litres.
Yeah, that's cute.
That's not going uphill on a 40-degree day with five people in it and the air conditioning running, right? Now, an electric car, if you put it on a motorway at 110... with the aircon on a really hot day, that 270K range might drop to 200, potentially. So you need to be aware of that.
John was just saying last question on electric vehicles.
You can ask as many as you
need. I didn't know he was producing the show now, yeah. but anyway.
He's in charge. Yeah. He's in charge.
I've just got a couple of other questions because it is a big topic with our listeners. I heard something the other day, and I don't know if it's just rubbish from the...
There's a bit of that.
Whatever movement,
yep.
but they're saying if I've got an electric vehicle, I'm doing at the moment worse for the environment because I'm actually using more power at home to charge it overnight.
Yeah, look, that's
I don't know if that's, we don't even have to go there, but I guess my question is,
yeah.
have you guys done any stats on fuel saving versus extra power bill and if there is a net benefit or gain on balance over a 3 month period or
basically,
something
basically
like
right now in Australia, if you're buying an electric car for environmental reasons, go and buy an efficient petrol vehicle.
Yeah.
Right? Because it just doesn't make any sense.
Petrol over diesel?
Yeah, petrol, probably an efficient petrol engine is probably better than diesel because diesel, they're a dirtier fuel. Yeah. They emit a little bit more. Electric vehicles, and I won't go right deep into it, but electric vehicles, and I forget the exact number, it's more than 50%. Somewhere around 60% are more energy inefficient off the production line. So day one rolls off the production line, it's 60% more energy inefficient than a petrol vehicle, an equivalent one. The problem is you don't start reducing that percentage difference until you're using completely green energy to charge it. So if I live out in the country and I've got this massive solar array and I've got a couple of Tesla power walls and I'm...
You're off the grid.
And I'm off the grid and I'm charging it that way, that is awesome. I'd recommend everybody do that
yeah,
if we could.
Absolutely.
Because it's
yeah.
great for the environment, right? But while ever you at home, when you turn your air conditioning on or you plug your toaster in, you can't dictate where your energy comes from and you don't know that it's green energy, we don't know, right? And then the other thing, yeah, there's the cost. Because we haven't yet seen... At the moment, people are running around using superchargers and the NRMA's put one in for free and the RACV's put
good advertising
in,
right, for them.
Great advertising. And at the moment, they're charging their car for free. I'll tell you what will happen. There's a petrol excise, right? So there's a tax on petrol that the government has pre-spent every year before they even get it. If 40%, and this is what we said with the shortened thing you mentioned, if 40% of the market, so that's 400,000 cars, are all of a sudden electric, where are they going to get that tax from? I guarantee you they'll get it off electricity. The government will look at it and go, you know what, everyone's charging their vehicles at home overnight off peak. Let's whack 2, 3, 4 cents, percent, whatever it might be, on top of their power bills.
It's a complex web.
They've got to get it from somewhere because they've factored it into their spending. Now, we all want less tax, not more, clearly, because it just makes life harder for everyone. But I think at the moment, if you can charge your car cheaply, accessing a, you know, if you get free charging with a really expensive one, or if you've got access to the motoring club's charging network or whatever, go for your life. But if you're charging it every night at home and you do a lot of driving, it's going to cost you.
I would love a Tesla. I've probably got the money to get a Tesla.
Mm.
But there's two reasons why I'm not buying one.
Tell me.
Number one, the charging thing. I don't want to, if I'm flat, what if I need to wait 2 hours somewhere to charge? I don't want to be stranded.
Yep.
Number two, I've got long term, just looking in at the longevity risks of actually the Tesla Motor Company, given that last year they have not made a profit yet.
They could very well go under.
And my view is exactly what you said, because somebody in the group asked this question. Jack said, yeah, what are your thoughts on the new generation hybrid and electrics for reliability, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
I basically were like, well, exactly what you said. When the incumbents start nailing it, that's when it will start to change.
Yeah.
See, the thing with the hybrid is it's a known quantity. So Jack there that wrote into you, it's a known quantity. You want to go and buy a RAV4 hybrid or a Corolla hybrid, go for your life. Toyota's got more than 10 years, I think, now of Prius hybrids driving around on the road. They know exactly how the battery packs behave. They know how they interact. And what's really interesting is our mobile phones, 12 or 18 months in, they don't hold as much charge as they did when they were new. Now, that's fine when you spend $1,000 on something, but not if you spend $100,000 on something, if it only has 80% of the charge. So manufacturers say, oh, no, don't worry about that. But then Tesla, for example, won't actually tell us if you use a supercharger every day.
Yeah.
They won't actually tell us what it does to the battery pack long term, right? So with hybrids, it's a known quantity. Pure electric, we don't really know yet because we don't have enough data from cars being on the road.
So how do hybrids charge? They charge themselves?
Yeah, the easiest way for your listeners to understand it, we've come up with this idea. I don't know if anyone else does it. I'm not claiming we invented it, but we have what we call full electric. Then we have what we call a plug-in hybrid. And then we have what we call a closed loop hybrid. So plug-in has X amount of electric range that it'll do, like 30 or 40 kilometers, and then it just shifts to a conventional engine. Those ones, you just plug them in at the wall, and because it's only 30 or 40 k's range, they don't take long to charge. Full electric is self-explanatory. Closed loop is exactly what you're asking. So there's an electric engine, and there's a petrol engine, and they just do their own thing and chop and change. So you might be crawling down outside your office here through the city, at 20 k's an hour, pure electric. Minute you put your foot down, the petrol engine kicks in.
Or if it's a million degrees and the aircon's on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you never actually physically plug it into anything. And to be honest, with the hybrid systems they have now, you have no clue what's doing what and how.
Really?
It's pretty seamless, yeah. You can actually, with the Toyotas, you can get a graph on the infotainment system that shows you what it's doing.
Right.
So it tells you whether the engine is charging the pack, whether it's running on pure electric, whether it's feeding it back. It's really clever.
Mm.
But hybrids are much, much less of a risk for a young buyer who's really careful about where their money's going, because we know they're a known quantity, pretty much.
Yeah. Okay, sweet. I want to swing back around today and just for 5 minutes, just to recap the insurances.
Sure.
Because if you've got a car, you've got insurance. So I'll just recap and I'll just do it very fast.
Go for it.
And if I miss anything, both of you jump in. Before you register your car, before you go to the RMS or whatever you are in your state, you must have your CTP, which is compulsory third party.
Yep.
So the governments will not let you register your car without CTP.
It's what we call a green slip.
In New South Wales, green slip. Yep. I don't know where it is elsewhere, but traditionally a green slip. Now,
less complicated everywhere else, by the way.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, New South Wales more painful than most.
Right.
Yeah.
So basically, if you go and register your car tomorrow and don't get any other insurance, and if you have a crash, that green slip, this compulsory third party, will only cover damage to blood and bones, basically, your flesh.
Other humans.
Other humans and yourself. So the next one down the line is, if you've got your car, there is what they call a third-party insurance. Now, what that is, it covers the third party, not you. So you've got a $2,000 piece of crap that you're driving around.
We've all been there.
Yep, I would like one. I'd like
some of us are still there.
I would like an AU Falcon, but I've got no room for it.
I was going to say, there's already two in your garage.
Yeah, exactly.
So if I've got my heap of crap AU Falcon / amazing car, and I've got third party insurance, I can hit a Lamborghini and the Lamborghini is covered.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
I can roll off the road and hit someone's private property and that's covered.
Yep.
If you don't have the third party insurance and you hit someone else or another person's property,
very expensive.
The insurance company will bankrupt you. Mm. Possibly. Mm. Okay.
Yeah, so it could get very ugly. And compulsory third party, we'd only recommend if you've got, me personally, I'd only recommend if you've got a cheap car, like you said.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So there would be a threshold where you would just take the risk and do the third party. The next one, and it is, you know, the insurance is optional except for the green slip, but the next one is your comprehensive insurance.
Yep.
So that will cover the damage of your own car and other people's car and property.
That's right. And look, if I could say, you know, your listeners are often starting out, they're young, they're new to this whole game. I know that comprehensive insurance is expensive. Mm-hmm. I understand that. And I've felt the same pain that you'd all be feeling now. But it's like anything. It's like having a good credit rating. If you get in with a company and you get compulsory third party plus your full comprehensive, you end up with a really good record going forward. And you won't feel it now if you're 20 or 21, but you will feel it when you're 30 or 31 and you're getting the full no-claim discount and, you know, you're getting maximum benefits from your insurance agency because you've had good insurance for a long time.
And this might seem obvious, but I meet some people who have only got third party, but the understanding is it doesn't cover their car.
That's right.
It covers everyone else's, in the event, but it doesn't cover their car.
That's right, yep.
So just this morning on the Facebook group, Nikila, she uploaded a photo, Focus.
Oh.
And she basically, and you can have a look in the photos there.
Oh, that doesn't look good.
She only had third party damage. Now she's only just starting out working 25 hours a week and she needs a car. Someone said, well, your third party damage, if someone else hits you, their insurance cover will cover you, okay? But she was at fault, so
that's the problem.
She's got a car that's written off. Now, that leads me, and because we're going to, in this episode, we're going to get to heaps of your questions, but I just need to set the scene with this basic stuff. I think we need to know when it's worth taking the risk on third-party damage and comprehensive insurance.
Yeah, it's only if your car is the throwaway item. So, you know, we've all had $1,500, $2,000, $3,000 cars that you think to yourself, well, it's going to cost me $800 a year to comprehensively insure it. So over 3 years, I'm going to pay back the value of the car, right?
Yeah.
So you don't insure it, you get your third party. If you run into someone else's car, they're covered, which is the right thing to do. Because let's be honest, leaving people in the lurch with a damaged car that you're not affording to fix is bad.
If you can't afford third party damage, and some insurers might do third party damage and then they might do another one third party if your car gets stolen.
Fire and theft,
or
burnt. Yep.
Now, I would say if you can't afford third party, the minimum third party, you can't afford a car.
That's a good way of putting it. Real simple. Yeah, absolutely.
Like because just straight
absolutely.
Up.
But I think if your car's over, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 mark and up, I think you need comprehensive.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to your own risk tolerance your financial position. So exactly what you said, I wrote this down 10 years ago or more or whatever it was. I had a Mitsubishi Mirage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great car. Can't kill them. I used to
see them everywhere back
then. I know.
In the day.
I did burnouts to the point where there was smoke coming through the air conditioning vents. Like, I hammered it. Like, just
killed it.
Crazy. It's just survived. Like, can't kill them. Dirty Mike had one. Drive it through water. That kills them. But that's another story. Now, it was worth $4,000.
Correct. Yep.
The comprehensive insurance was $800 a year.
That's right.
Now, I took the risk. I'm like, well, life's full of risks.
Yeah.
I'm not going to put $800 a year into this car. I'll take the risk if I crash and it's written off, I've got to come up with another $3,000.
To buy another car, yeah.
Because I've already put $1,000 into it for insurance, so technically. Now, I will say though, if you are starting out and your life's a mess financially, and that's not having a go at you,
it's not unusual, absolutely.
And you do have a low value car, it might be worth keeping the comprehensive just until you get on top of your financial life.
Oh, that's a good point because then you won't be able to afford it.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and then one step further, you know why, John? I'm a fan of comprehensive insurance, even for smaller value items.
Replacement.
No.
You tell me then.
Hassle factor. I'll give you an example. I had a $4,500 motorbike. I didn't need to be insured.
I know what you're about to say, yeah.
With comprehensive insurance, if somebody hit me, right, and they were at fault, okay? If they weren't insured and I wasn't insured, It's between me and them to try and get money out of them. I had a lady hit the side of my door once of a car at a roundabout. I was comprehensively insured, called NRMA, shout out NRMA.
Yeah, I've been with NRMA for a while.
I have for a million years. Mm. I called NRMA and they said, drop it here to get repaired. We'll take it from here.
Yep.
For all we know, they could still be pursuing that woman.
The money, exactly. Yeah,
so it's the hassle factor. So the reason I took comprehensive insurance for my motorbike was if someone bumped into it and knocked it over and it was, I can just call them and they would chase the money.
It's a really good point.
But you've got companies, third-party companies now, like Not My Fault, that will pursue that on your behalf.
They won't pursue that on your behalf. They'll only give you a car and pursue the other person's insurance company to get the funding for the hire car.
So you're talking replacement as well as...
I'm talking
repair,
everything.
A loan vehicle if you're entitled to it. Yeah, okay. Right.
So I am pretty... Because I'm conservative by nature, I'm probably more bullish to have insurance because I don't like hassle in my life.
The thing is, if you're not involved in the motor trade like we are at Car Advice, you don't know smash repairers and people that can, you know, give you this and that. So you just want to make one phone call to an insurance agency and say, can you fix my car?
It's definitely a hassle factor.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's it. So, you might have a cheaper car, but if it's only an extra $400 a year to get comprehensive on top of the third-party damage... Yeah, all right, let's do it anyway.
Yeah, good point.
Now, just a couple of things, how to get a lower price for your comprehensive insurance. Number one, you know, if you've got an emergency fund in place, maybe push the excess up from $600 to $1,000.
And shop around.
And
too,
shop around.
Absolutely shop around.
You might take the judgment call on the windscreen and hire car option.
Yep.
Again, hassle factor for me. I've always had those on the policy, but I've paid for it.
Yep.
Multi-policy discounts. I've got all my cars... Well, I've only got two. I sold my motorbike, but I had them and I think I've got my roadside membership with NRMA. So you get the packaging discounts.
I've got five cars and five motorbikes insured with Shannon's. Don't go there. I need therapy. But
yeah, we will go there in the after party.
For the listeners there, I'm sitting in a room with seven cars, right? And two people.
And two people. Yeah, and the thing is they're all insured with Shannon's and you do get a hefty discount when you bundle everything together.
And Shannon's,
because a lot of mine are old,
right?
Classic vehicles.
Like you, John.
Like me.
And loyalty bonus and no claim bonus.
Yeah, 100%.
With any, I don't care who you are, insurance company and time, those things together are your friend.
Yep.
And I know for a fact, if you've been a customer for 10 minutes and there's a curly thing where there could be a judgment call for a manager sitting at a desk, if they go, this person's been a customer for 10 years, we'll help them out.
Mm.
I've seen it with insurance companies.
100%. Yep.
So for me, I personally don't do a lot of shopping on my policies. But if money is tight, if you're starting out, you've got to shop the market.
Yeah, and just realizing that cheap isn't always better either.
No. Well, it's funny.
The same as anything.
Do you know with all these online insurers, Trent, like I did some cost comparisons. They'll advertise, we're $900 cheaper than the average or whatever. When you do a like-for-like, NRMA versus online.com.au, add back all the windscreen hire car, it was $100 difference. And I'm like, not going there.
At best, the same for green slips. I've found almost categorically that NRMA is cheaper for green slips for me on just about every car and motorcycle I've ever had to register. Right? Yeah, absolutely. So always shop around.
So let's talk about, and I know that you do a lot of new car reviews. Mm. So let's rewind. You're in your job 5 years ago. Mm. So I want to talk about maybe secondhand.
Yeah, yeah.
And the concepts of buying dealership versus private. Let's discuss that.
Okay. So for us with secondhand cars, we always say, and we get asked this on the radio show we do a lot, we always say, make sure the car has a full service history and if possible, at a dealer. So let's say you're buying a Ford. If it's got a service history with Ford of X, you know, it doesn't matter what city you live in. If it's been taken to Ford, full service history, zero risk. And in fact, you might have more bargaining power secondhand than you do through a dealer. Dealers are good though as well because they often have them as fully approved secondhand vehicles with, 3 months warranty or a warranty of some kind. But for me, the key is always a full service history with the manufacturer. And then, of course, the other stuff, the simple stuff. If you've got the cash, go there and take the cash with you. If you intend on spending 15 grand and you've got 15 grand, take it with you. Wave it in the guy's face and go, mate, you've got 18 grand on the car. Here's 15. You can wave goodbye to it if I leave now. And believe me, they want to sell cars.
Yeah.
You know, so especially dealers, but also private sellers want to sell cars. So do that as well. And don't be afraid of buying a secondhand car by any means, because modern cars are pretty good. And if they've been serviced and maintained, there's not too many skeletons in the closet.
Yeah. I think a couple of what you've touched on, but don't be afraid. Like, you're about to spend 10, 15, 20 grand.
It's a lot of money.
Don't be afraid to go to Redbook, for example. I did this.
Yeah, Redbook's a good resource.
And have a look at what... So, redbook.com.au, what it is, they list every car and it will tell you a range of price,
based
trade
on
kilometers, which is wholesale cost versus private.
Correct.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, you're spending all this money. If you get to the point where it's like, I know I want X car, spend $260 and get a pre-purchase inspection. Now, when this episode goes up, someone in the Facebook group just put up and remind me to put it up there. I'll put up an inspection report that I did on a car in Coffs Harbour because I wanted to, you know, look at it.
Well, you couldn't see it yourself.
And I couldn't I couldn't be bothered, and I wasn't going to go up there and, you know, play the game if it was a heap of crap. Now, a lot of those reports are pretty templated, but you just want to know if the mechanic sees that there's a heap of friggin' oil coming out of the CV joint.
Any glaring issues, exactly.
You know, a lot of them, there's going to be disclaimers out to Wazoo that they're not responsible, but, you know, if it's a 10-year-old car, it's going to be 10 years old, people.
Like, yeah, 100%. And the other thing I'd say as well is if you're looking at two vehicles, say your budget's, I don't know, $10,000, for example, and you're looking at a vehicle that's $9,500 and it's got 120,000 kilometres on it, and you're looking at a vehicle that's 11,000 and it's got 70,000 Ks on it, try to stretch yourself to the one with less kilometres, because you're buying yourself time.
Yeah.
You know, if a car's got a 500,000 kilometre lifespan and you're looking at 150 versus 100,000 Ks, you're buying yourself 50,000 kilometres if you buy the one with the lower kilometres.
I've got, if you Google Glenn James how much to spend on a car, it'll be the first hit. I usually say...
Because it's the only one.
Shut up. You shut up and you shut up.
No, I was just laughing at him.
You're a guest here,
I am
Trent.
A guest, sorry. My apologies. No.
I always say the sweet spot, if you want to buy a quote-unquote new... within 4 years old, you're around 60,000 Ks.
Absolutely.
That's generally your sweet spot.
Yep.
Now, I know there's going to be people listening who, you know, don't have 2 cents to scratch together at the moment and they need a cheap car. But if you do have some runs on the board financially and you do need an upgrade, a new car, that's going to be your sweet spot. Now, another thing that you need to do as well, and you can get a Carfax report and it's all part of Redbook and all that crap. It's $29. The pre-purchase inspection that I did for $260 included this report. It will tell you if the car is stolen.
Has ever been stolen.
Has ever been stolen. Has ever been written off. Or if there's finance on the car. Now, the important thing to know, and this is probably a big deal when buying privately, is I'll give you an example, John, and to everyone out there listening. If you went to buy a car that... was worth $10,000, for example, and that person got a car loan. The reason a car loan interest rate is cheaper is because they attach the finance to the asset and they call it encumbered.
Not the person,
Not the person. So that means it's lower because they've got higher chance of getting the money back and less risk for them. So if you went and bought a $10,000 car privately, gave them 10 grand cash without doing a car report, if in a year's time, the person you bought it off still hadn't paid off the car loan and sold it, transferred the rego papers to you, that car loan bank or whatever has legal right to come and repo the car.
Yeah, it's not good.
And
it's
sell
not
it.
Good if there's money owing on
it. So that's the number one thing when buying privately.
I had a good friend of mine, young bloke actually. Nick is 21, I think he is, and he he saved a bunch of money. I think he bought a $45,000 or $50,000 car. He worked, you know, a bunch of different jobs. Saved all his cash. This was all he ever wanted. When he did the report that Glenn's talking about, was he found out that the car had finance on it. So he said to the guy, So say the car was 50 grand and it still had 30 grand on it. He said to the guy, I'm going to give a check to the finance company for 30,000 and you're only going to see 20. And they negotiated that deal. And the guy said, yep, fine, absolutely no problem.
Yep.
You don't want that to happen without you being aware of it, which is what you're talking about.
Totally.
And I think the key, what we're saying is you've got to have the resources and knowledge to be able to know what questions to ask when it comes to transact. I mean, most of the cars I've bought over time have been private, as opposed to dealership.
Yep.
But like the simple trick of going on the last day of the month to the dealership because he wants to
get something out the door.
Gets his extra before the new month starts.
Absolutely.
An easy one, isn't it?
So it is. Absolutely.
The tips and tricks.
So another thing, people want to know how much to spend on a car. I generally say as little as possible.
The best car you can get for as least amount of money.
Yeah. There's some guides out there. So people say 3 months worth of gross income. I generally say as a guide, you do not want, I'll make a number up for John. So John and Amy, you know, great family, good people, or as Trump would say, great people. you guys, as a family, you both work and 60 grand each.
Mm.
So as a household, you earn 120K.
Yeah.
As a rule of thumb, I would not want John and Amy to own more than 50% of their income in cars. So it'd be a 30 grand car each max.
Because, 60 total, yep.
Yeah, you do not want...
That's pretty high still,
but... It is, but that's a maximum.
Yeah.
Actually, it might even be net online. Have a look at my car blog. The whole thing is you just need some guidelines in place.
Yeah.
Yep. And don't overspend. Don't get sucked into, you know, young first-time buyers who are really trying to... You know, a car in Australia is more than just a way to get to work. We're very car-centric. We love cars, right? And young people... It's easy to fall into that trap of putting too much value in what the car says about you.
Yeah.
And a lot of people do that. So they want a particular type of car because I want to look at you, mate, and I want you to see me a certain way. It's why so many blokes are buying dual cab utes they don't need, right?
I've never known a tradesperson who needs a brand new $80,000 ute.
None of the workers do.
Build better.
No, none of the workers do. They're all driving old alloy trayback ones and vans, you know. But the thing is, don't fall into the trap of walking through a dealership, seeing all the flashing lights. You know, like Volkswagen at the moment, they've got this great deal on its 1% finance or 1.9% finance. Mm. Don't look at that and go, wow, that means I can spend 60 grand instead of 25 because the finance is so cheap.
Yeah.
It especially when you're starting out, you just don't need to do anything silly. I think you start small. It's the same as buying a house. It's the same as your first holiday. You know, your first holiday, you're not going to go to Monaco and spend $5,000 a night in a hotel room when you're 20 years old. You start out and you learn how to build on top of it. So don't feel like you're down in the dumps because you can't afford the best car in the world either, because we've all got to start somewhere.
No, I think that's a critical point, Trent. I think people get sucked into the fact that it's so easy to get car loans these days, on the spot almost, or within 24 hours, and say, well, okay, well, if they're giving it to me, I must be able to afford it.
Yeah, and I'll put a correction in there. You're right. I got confused. It is net take-home income. So for both of you, 120K, you both had 80K net.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want more than 40K of stuff with motors in them.
So you work the number after tax.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, and there's the big discussion, novated lease or not. We're not getting into that this episode. There's other resources. Ask the Facebook group. There's other episodes about that. But if you are doing finance, never, ever, ever do it more than 4 years.
Okay. Yes.
Ever.
Yeah. I'm doing it 5.
I still disagree, but that's cool. You do you.
We're different humans.
Yeah, we are. Mm. Where possible, put down a deposit. I say if you can put down 20% into your car at any time throughout, whether the car's a write-off or you have to sell it because the situation changes.
You're in front of the game,
you're
aren't you?
Never underwater in the car.
Point. That's a really good point.
I'm also not doing that either.
No.
But pre-framing, as cross. I said, it's another conversation when you're a business owner, you've got tax deductions,
yeah, absolutely.
Et cetera. So,
And this is the thing, Trent. With cars or money, 9 times out of 10, we're lying in the bed that we make for ourselves.
Yeah, of course we are.
So if you want more financial stress in your life, buy an expensive car with finance.
It'll give you that.
Yeah, that's as simple as that.
As a standout, a vehicle is the most emotional look at me.
It is. even more than your house, because people don't see you driving your house around every day, you know.
Right.
And as we, one of my taglines I use on radio all the time is, it's the second most expensive thing most of us will ever buy.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not to be.
Is the first one a bride?
Mate, I'm not married. I'm 43 and I'm not married.
The first one. So,
yeah. Actually, wait.
The second one's a divorce.
Do I need to edit that out? Is that bad? It was a joke, everyone. It was a joke.
Some women are out there thinking, hang on, the husband was pretty expensive.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what I was about to say.
Usually he's more expensive because he buys cars.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Sorry, everyone. If you're still listening now, you're probably a bit of a, you already get us. You haven't turned off that much. All right. So what should I look for when purchasing my first car?
Look, I think just to try to get through it as quickly as possible, a lot of what you've just said already, you guys have spoken about the financing, the money, the insurance, all that kind of thing. When you go, if you're buying it from a dealer, see if you can factor in other stuff like the running and repair costs. So for example, if your car's 25 grand and they say, we've got this great package that will cover all your servicing for the first 5 years for $5,000, bundle it in, do it. Because I can tell you now, when you take the car into service and all of a sudden you've got a $500, $600, $700 bill you didn't expect, that can hurt if you haven't prepared for it. But what I think you should be looking for is to get the lowest kilometres, get the safest car you can buy, and just make sure, you said it before, mate, just make sure you don't extend yourself.
Doesn't mean you have to get a Volvo though, does it?
No, it doesn't. Absolutely not. No, definitely not. Cars are pretty safe now.
I would say as well, and speaking of Volvos, I will put that report in the Facebook group. I think I mentioned it before, just so you can see. Mm. I was looking at a Volvo Polestar S60.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Interesting choice.
Yeah.
Good car.
Not only looked at it, he bought it.
No, I didn't buy that. I just got the S60 here. On that, Linda, I don't know your circumstances, and I think anyone buying their first car, I would be looking under 10 grand with cash. Straight up.
Great advice. That's what I did.
Yeah, straight up.
Absolutely. Great advice.
If you can save 5 grand, buy a 5 grand beater. Then save some more, sell it, and then buy the next one with cash. Try and not get into the debt cycle when you're first out of the gate.
And the other thing to keep in mind, guys, too, is what you think you want when you're young and you're buying your first, second vehicle and what you actually want could be two vastly different things. Like I've test driven so many cars now that I understand if I buy car X, it's rubbish at all these things and I have to accept that because I want it to do one thing. Like, for example, if I want a four-wheel drive that goes off-road properly, it's rubbish everywhere else, but it goes off-road really well.
Yeah.
So you might see the new Suzuki Jimny, which for your listeners is a little four-wheel drive. It looks amazing. It's funky. It's really retro. It's pretty much rubbish everywhere except off-road. So you might look at it and go, that's what I want to spend my 25 grand on. And then you go and do what you said, which is borrow money, get finance, spend your 25 grand, drive it for a week and go, why did I do this?
Yeah.
You're looking at your next door neighbor or your mate from uni or whatever driving a Toyota Corolla and you're thinking, I'd rather be in that because I need a small hatchback. Yeah. So yeah, that's a lot safer way of doing it because you can buy the car and go, whoops, made the wrong decision and sell it again.
Yeah, but I would think that 90% of people would buy cars not on practicality, but how they look.
In Australia.
Absolutely.
On emotion. Yeah. We are car enthusiasts in Australia. We don't buy them as a conveyance. Yeah. Absolutely. They're an emotional purchase. They're because of what they say about us or how we feel when we drive it or what it looks like, 100%.
So on that first car, Uncle Glenn's advice would be cheap as possible with cash.
Yep, I like it.
Now, that leads on to another question that was in the group and there was a few people commenting and I'm not going to open their names, but I said I would explain my position more. We get car fever. We get emotional. We do dumb things.
I'll give
you an example and it's about safety. Okay. Absolutely. I want everyone to have the safest car they can afford.
100%.
Okay. The biggest fallacy I see and hear is we're pregnant. We've got to buy a brand new car because it's safest. You can't buy a car because of that, because your logic is BS. Because if you buy a car based on that, that's brand new, every single year, you have to buy the new model.
Correct.
So that's a fallacy.
Yes.
And people, they go and buy these brand new cars because they're the safest with debt and they can't afford it. And mum or dad's back out working part time just to pay the freaking car payment.
Mm. Yeah.
So it is absolutely a fallacy.
Yep.
Now, there was a comment in there about don't just go and buy a cheap, reliable Japanese car, buy something that's safe. To be honest, I'm going out on a limb. A Japanese Corolla within the last 10 years is probably pretty safe.
Yeah. Oh, mate, look at Subaru, for example. Every car they've sold in Australia in the last, it'd be 10 years now, is a 5-star ANCAP safety-rated car.
Yeah.
Every car.
I want that green Bentley that's on the car Instagram cars advice. I want that because it looks bloody
do,
safe.
Actually, yeah.
I can't afford it.
Yeah.
I don't have
$500,000 in cash laying around?
Yeah.
No, neither do
I. So I, and there's people there that they were in a car accident and someone died. I totally get that.
Yep.
Life is full of risks. We've got to be pragmatic, not have car fever and do dumb things.
That's right.
Based on an emotional thing.
Speaking of risks and safety, I was in the passenger seat of your car about a month ago. It was high risk, and I didn't feel safe when you were sideways around.
And it's got nothing to
bit.
Do with the car. Yeah, yeah, it's the driver, right. Exactly.
So, I don't know. Do you want to talk to the whole safety thing?
Yeah, and look, the best thing you can do is use ANCAP as a resource. So, ANCAP, ANCAP. It's the Australasian New Car Assessment Program, I think it stands for. They do all the crash testing, right? So go to ancap.com.au and type in, if you're looking at buying a 2015 Toyota Corolla, put all that data in and it'll tell you what the rating of that car was when it was new. So if it was a 5-star rated car when it was new, you're already off on the right foot, okay? The problem with the safety ratings is those of us that work in the industry, like I do, we struggle to understand it, let alone if you're a layperson. So it's not actually that easy to understand. I'll give you an example. There was a particular type of Kia, exactly the same car. The middle grade, so the top grade got a 5-star safety rating. The middle grade got a 4-star safety rating because it was missing a warning light for the middle seat belt in the back row. So structurally, the car was identical.
Wow.
So if you ran it into a tree at 60 kilometres an hour, both cars, you're two people in the car, exactly the same outcome. Yeah. Structurally, no problem. There are little sort of intricacies within the ruling that are like that. So sometimes when a car gets 4 stars, it's not structurally unsound. If a car has 1, 2, or 3 stars, it starts to get to the point where it's structurally unsound. If it's 5, it's about the best you can get. At the moment. So, yeah, you can go to ANCAP and find that out. That's not a problem.
Yeah, so I just don't want people to borrow more money than they need to on the safety fallacy.
You don't want to put them
in. And realistically, any 5-star, and I'm saying Jap car because we'll get into servicing and maintenance, right?
Hmm.
Generally speaking, it's cheaper to get a new radiator for a Toyota than for an Audi.
Yeah, that's generally the case. Going out on a limb here,
yeah, people.
That's generally the case.
And actually, I'm just on the ANCAP website as we speak, and the Toyota Prado from 2013 onwards has the same safety rating.
Correct.
So that's 6 years old, isn't it?
Yeah, because they haven't changed the car dramatically. Yeah,
so it's a 5-star rating from 2013 onwards. Mm-hmm. So you don't need the 2019 model.
No. Not necessarily.
For safety anyway.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. So, absolutely. Just take risks in life. If you want to get something safe and older, get a Volvo.
Yeah. Yep. But that's the thing. Like,
they invented the freaking airbag. You want to be safe.
Any car from the last 10 years that was from a major manufacturer will have been safe when it was released.
Yeah. Yep. And that's it. It's like we're getting to the point where above the line is good enough.
Mm.
And most cars are above the line good enough.
Yeah.
Let's go to another question. Melissa asks, unleaded 91 versus unleaded 98, is the extra money worth it?
Absolutely.
Really?
100%.
Even if I've got a 12-year-old crap box?
Generally speaking, yes. I never put E10 in anything.
No, neither do I.
Do not ever put E10 in any car, even if it says it can take it. Really? Always stump up for 95 if you can afford it. What you will notice with 98 is without boring everybody to death, it burns cleaner, it burns more efficiently.
Right.
So it's a better option to put in a car over the longer period. So if you're going to own your car for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, the better fuel you put in, the better. Old school 91 that's not E10 is still okay. There's nothing wrong with it, but 95 or 98 is better.
Sweet. Michelle asks, and she may have been crossing a wires here, is roadside assistance worth it or just have emergency fund for the off chance? Well, if you've got $10,000 in your emergency fund and you break down on the side of the road, it's not going to help you.
Not going to get you off that country road
exactly.
At 2 o'clock in the morning.
So,
you know, there's something really interesting here, and I used to work at the NRMA, so I have no axe to grind. But the reason the motoring clubs around Australia are diversifying so much is – stop and think how many times you see a new car broken down on the side of the road.
They don't anymore.
They don't actually break down that much. So unless your car is really old, like some of my old junkers, unless it's really old, you really don't need roadside assistance.
Or unless you're me.
And you, okay, why do you have a way of braking cars?
I get lazy and can't be bothered fueling up, and I run out of fuel on the side of the road.
You know, there's a gauge there that actually it tells you.
Oh, and so it tells you. So the orange light means fuel up.
Fuel up, that's right. Not, that doesn't mean keep driving.
And anything later than 5 years ago probably beeps at you as well.
Yeah, exactly. So look, I tell you where.
I've used it twice in the last 6 months.
You know one example where the roadside assistance really does come into play is a flat battery.
Yes.
Because batteries are big and heavy and annoying, and you've often got to go somewhere to get one. So that could be a pain if you don't have roadside, or a flat tire in the middle of nowhere. And if you've got one of these new cars that doesn't have a spare, or it's got a,
I'm putting my hand up.
Yeah, so that would be one of my criterias for going and buying your first car.
Full size spare.
Make sure it's got a full size spare.
Yeah, me too, mate.
And
I agree.
And number two, make sure you know how to change it.
Exactly. Yep.
It was funny. Like, the Volvo that I've got doesn't have a spare. Popped a, because I got it secondhand, and the tyres were rubbish. And I was saying to someone the Friday before that, I'm just too lazy. I've got to get new tyres. That Sunday, it popped. Like,
on a
the
Sunday
war.
Of all days.
Yeah, so I had to park it in Newcastle, borrow a friend's car, go back to the coast, then get roadside to tow it to a tyre. Like, it's just a debacle.
It is a debacle.
But I'm just looking here, NRMA roadside, basically $113 a year.
It's cheap.
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, why wouldn't you? Exactly.
So it's good if you do that, or if you're like me and run out of fuel because you're lazy.
And to answer our question, was it Michelle, did you say?
Yes.
Yeah. Look, Michelle, the other thing too is your you know, emergency fund's a great idea if your engine blows up or your gearbox blows up or you need four new tyres you weren't expecting or whatever. That's great. The problem is that emergency fund, as you said before, mate, won't get you off the side of the road at 2 o'clock in the morning. And often it's something that's not going to require tens of thousands of dollars to fix. You know, sometimes when cars break down, it's a $20 part or something. It is minor. So yeah, that $113 is a good investment.
Sweet. What we're going to do, we're going to end the episode right there, right now. And we'll just, if you've got 10 more minutes.
Yeah, mate, I've got 10 minutes.
We'll come back and do a little bonus episode because we just want to keep these episodes kind of under the hour. But we'll come back and do another My Millennial Answers. And we've got 1, 2, 3, 4. There's about 6 questions that we're going to answer.
Sure.
And thanks for coming on. You can find Trent at Car Advice on Instagram.
Yeah, on Instagram, Trent Nikolic, Nikolic on Instagram. Just follow me there.
Sweet.
See what I'm driving and when.
Yeah, love it.
Thanks, Trent.
No worries. Awesome.
Thanks for coming in. See you, mate. Bye.
If you're after personal financial advice, this podcast is not for you. But if you do want a financial advisor or mortgage broker to talk with about your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click Get Help, and we'll put you in touch with one of our trusted professionals. If you're looking for a super fund that puts its members' interests above all else, choose a super performer, Sun Super. With low fees, strong investment returns, and great member services, Sun Super is Super Ratings 2020 Fund of the Year and has also been awarded by Money Magazine, Canstar, and Finder. Find out more about Sun Super at sunsuper.com.au/choose. You can join Sun Super online in under 5 minutes.
My Millennial Money supports A21. A21 is a non-profit organisation that exists to abolish slavery everywhere. These guys rescue real people from human trafficking across the world. If you want to learn more about how you can contribute to the fight against human trafficking, check out a21.org/au.
Thanks to Jess Knaus, executive producer, Chris Burke, sound engineer, Laura from La La Social Club, and me, Asher. Anyway, make sure you stay connected via Instagram, our free Facebook group, or if you want to turn it up a notch and be on the inside of the show, become a member of M3 Private. For further information about what's going on, check out the links in the show notes.
What's in your car collection?
So I have a 2005 Smart 4.2 because I went to Europe. My family's Italian. I spend a bit of time overseas. I see them everywhere and I just got besotted with them and they're just like tiny little midget things. But I love them. I've got one of them. I have a 1960 Fiat 600, which is a little old, again, an Italian car, that one. I've got a 1966 Chevy C10 pickup, which is an American truck that I'm currently doing a whole bunch of stuff to. So the idea with that is that it'll be like a brand new V8 Commodore underneath, but it looks like a knockabout old truck. I'm forgetting something, I think. Oh, yeah, I had, until yesterday, I had a 1985 Ford Spectron van that found, that I bought just because my mate found it. Oh, I've forgotten one other car too. My mate found and said, you've got to buy this. It's cheap. I can't add another car to my collection. And I just went, yep, I'll buy it. I've also got a 1970 Volkswagen Combi van. Wow. And I've had a bunch of old Combis and Beetles over the years, but that one will probably be sold. Then I've got two 1961 Vespas. I've got a 2009 Aprilia sports bike.
Nice.
And I've got a 2013 Harley Davidson Road King.
Oh, wow.
A big touring bike, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in my dad's shed, I've also got a 1953 Vespa, which is really, really, really old and just like a collectible kind of thing that you just do up and you put it on a wall because they're too slow and clunky to actually ride.
Yeah.
The 61 Vespa is pretty cool. You can ride them. I ride them. They're registered. They're not fast.
Yeah.
But the 53 is just too slow.
Mm. Oh, that's... And so you're daily, you can just borrow one from any of the car people.
Yeah, I'm always in new cars at work, so I don't need a new car because I'm always in them.
How do I become a car editor like yourself?
Mate, the problem is there's no jobs. You know, that's the thing. It's such a specialist niche thing in Australia, such a niche thing. And the industry has... it's shrunk so much. So when Channel 9 bought Car Advice, so my boss now effectively is Channel 9, and when they bought Car Advice, they also bought Fairfax, which brought drive.com.au as well. So we are Car Advice and Drive. So I'm actually the managing editor of Car Advice and Drive,
right,
which is drive.com.au, and the print section in the Herald and the Age and all that stuff. So once upon a time, they were two separate entities with two separate lots of staff. Now it's one. So there's probably, I don't know, there might be... probably less than 30 motoring journalists in Australia. Wow.
Do you want to ever do a piece on like buying your first car or something?
You'd love to.
With My Millennial Money or something?
Love to. Whenever you want me back, I'll be here.
No, but no, I mean like, can I guest write for your column or something?
Oh, you want a job. I thought you wanted to be back on your podcast.
I know, just a volunteer. I want you back here.
Let me have a think about it. I've got very exacting standards from the staff.
Yeah, you don't want me then. So I wanted to give everyone's... So I put a video up the other day on the Facebook group a couple of months now when you listen to this about my new car and everyone wanted an update. I've still got the Volvo S60 and it's the T6 and it's a lot of fun.
Yep.
But I got rid of the Lexus at the end of last year and I've been eyeing off Lexus again and I actually just bought a 2015 RC350 F-Sport.
Nice car. Lovely car.
Yeah, just... So, for everyone at home, like, I went to Redbook and just got a bit of... And I've been looking at them and saving them in, you know, the car sale apps and all that.
Yep.
And the private sale price said the lowest would be 38K. So, the guy had it on for 36.9. And I rocked up. And I said, oh, how much would you take? This was private, everyone. And he said 36 and a half. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I got 35.
Good move.
If you want it.
Really good move.
But there's still some on car sales for 45 and 43. Mm. So I stole it almost.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
that's a lot of car for the money.
Totally. And it's got the disgusting red leather.
Yeah,
and
it's
just
all good.
Beautiful.
All good.
And he had black aftermarket rims on there with good tires, and he said, I've also got the brand new rims if you want them as well. I said, absolutely.
Ones. Yeah, I'll take
so
them.
I put the factory ones back on there. There's $1,500 worth of rubber.
Mm. Of course there is, yeah.
So that's what I'm driving now, everyone. It's a lot of fun. Mm. I've decided to keep the Volvo as well because the Lexus is a pain in the ass because it's so bloody low. Mm. But back to your point earlier in the episode with the test driving.
Yeah.
I've got some metal grates at the end of my driveway. I've got to get a new metal plate
because
the Lexus is even too low.
Sure. Happens a lot.
We talked about stuff to consider. There was a question. I don't think we got to it. Out of the blue, expenses when buying a car. Mm-hmm. So for me, the first one was, and I totally forgot about this. I went to in New South Wales, it's the Service New South Wales, or RMS, changed the regio over. It was freaking $1,000.
Yeah.
So that's number one, the stamp duty when transferring a car.
Yep.
So you've got to look after that. So that almost fell off the chair.
Yeah, like, you got to have that put aside.
$1,000 freaking. Are you kidding me?
I just paid $35 for the car.
Yeah, exactly. So that was there.
Yep.
The second thing as well, and I'm in a fortunate enough position not to need to pinch my pennies as much as maybe other people. The other thing as well, jumped on to insure the bastard.
Oh, yes.
$2,500 and
welcome to premium vehicle ownership.
It's a pain in the ass.
It is.
And a tip for young players, the no-claim bonus protection and discounts, particularly with NRMA, it's not at Glenn James level. It's a policy level.
Correct.
So, I had to pay to get the 60% no-claim bonus this policy.
That's right.
Because I want to keep the Volvo as my daily. And like I'm in the city today, I live on the Central Coast. Mm. I'm not parking the Lexus QVB car park to get hit and smashed and go down the ramp. So
exactly.
So that's what I'm doing, everyone. And because I put it up and some people had a bit of a go at me, like, oh, I'm not going to, like all the crap.
Mm, all the usual stuff.
You can't compare your own financial situation to someone else's.
No, definitely not.
So for complete disclosure, I've got $45,000 worth of car now because the Volvo's only worth, I paid $13 for it and I got a good deal for that. Mm. I've only got $45,000 worth of car in total, which is well under 50% of my net take-home income.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I pay cash for them.
Yep, so you own them.
So I own them.
Yep.
Pure
toy. It's a way to do it if you can.
Totally.
Yep.
And then the third out-of-pocket expense with the stuff I didn't know, I went to the metal shop to order a new plate for the front of the driveway. $1,200. So
get a new driveway.
Oh, so
it adds up.
But yeah, the Lexus, it was funny, the Volvo being all-wheel drive, turning circle the size of Texas.
Yeah, exactly.
It's getting back into the Lexus, and particularly with all-wheel steer, the turning circle's great. Difference.
Yeah, turn on 10 cent piece.
So good. Mm-hmm. So, but my next step is to probably get into a DB9.
It's just a little step up, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it is and it isn't. I mean,
James Bond.
Well, but this is the thing. Like, I was looking at 09, 10 DB9s. 110, 120 grand. And I talk about this on the show all the time, scratching the itch.
Mm.
I scratched that itch with 35 grand.
Yeah, of course you did. Of course
so
you did.
It's about, and I didn't have car fever. I paid cash. I was strategic.
Yep.
And
didn't
it's what
do
I,
anything stupid.
I was doing what I enjoy, and that's enjoying my cars.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's a bit of an update for everyone who's a regular listener. I've got the new Lexus. Well, it's 4 years old. Still smells brand new and all that. It's, and the reason why I went Lexus to start with, and this is for everyone who's interested in luxury cars, off the bat, they're 20 grand cheaper across the, I reckon, across the line or broad statement than Euros.
Mm.
So.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. At
least. And they're probably just as refined.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a Toyota.
Yeah.
So, very good car.
Absolutely.
Hey, thanks for coming in today.
Mate, great
to
be
really
here.
Cool. But
no,
yeah,
no, it's great to be
we'll
here.
We'll get
really
you back because or we might even get you. I'll come down one evening to the office and we might do a live Q&A in the Facebook group because there's over 6,000 of us hanging out there now.
Awesome.
And
that'd be great. We could do it in the Car Advice garage or something. Yeah.
Yeah, and as well, it's because, you know, I haven't done this. We've had this podcast for 18 months and I've never done an episode on cars.
Right.
But they're in everyone's life.
Mm, of course they are.
So it's just crazy.
Anytime, mate. Great to be with you.
No worries. All right. Appreciate it, Trent.